Mojave Beach Productions.
Mojave Beach Productions and the Voice of Haulana bring you stories of faith and inspiration, made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International.
Mojave Beach Productions and the Voice of Haulana present Dear Dean, Love, Mom. Made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International and narrated by Esther Luttrell.
I don't want to stray too far from the subject of people Dean was sending to me, but I can't write about things deeply spiritual without including an incident that happened while I was still in Mount Dora. Larry was gone. I was uncertain of my future and, without the talk show, financially devastated. Larry and I had spent what money we had on our move and an unstable year trying to decide what direction to take. He took a direction south. I was stranded. Not wanting to fight during what I hoped would be an amiable divorce, I agreed to take nothing financially, and nothing is what I got. A bunch of it. True, I could remain in the Mount Dora home, but it was up to me to figure out how to make the monthly payments, plus finance its upkeep. Quite a challenge. Somehow the writing assignments came along, always in the nick of time, but never with anything left above bare necessities. Yet I was grateful. How many times did I walk out under the arbor to sit in a lawn chair and gaze up at a peaceful, star-filled sky, thanking God for His goodness. Despite the divorce, Earth seemed to be a lovely place, filled with so much opportunity and wonder. I often think as I look at a beautiful sunset or a particularly breathtaking stretch of beach or desert, that God has given us so much. Everything of His on this planet is perfect. Now, what man has done to it's another story. In those moments, I often whisper to Him, "Please forgive us, God. You've given us everything, and we have junked it up terribly. I'm so sorry." I had the hour-long radio show, Sentimental Journey, on Sunday afternoons that I loved hosting, and an account executive responsible for the show whom I adored. Roger Clary became a cherished friend. His death in 2001 drew his wife Helen and me closer. She has since become my best buddy, the sister I never had. One Sunday I was running late getting to the radio station. I jumped out of the shower and raced into the bedroom to get the underwear I'd forgotten to bring to the bathroom with me. I was running across the tile floor with wet feet when a throw rug skittered out from under me. I remember how everything went to slow motion as I crashed down on my spine. In a split second before landing full force on the tile, I repeated rapidly, "All is well. God knows nothing of accidents. He is my perfect God, and I am His perfect child." It's hard to believe that I had presence of mind to remember to acknowledge our Father, even as a crisis was in progress, but I did. In that instant, I heard a distinct crack in my tailbone. The pain was excruciating. I flipped over almost a reflex action to my hands and my knees, and I stayed that way, repeating over and over that all was well, that God was with me. Unable to stand, I crawled to the dresser, pulled out my underwear, and somehow, still on my hands and knees, managed to get myself dressed. You know, when you have a radio show, you can't just call in sick. There's air. And in radio, there's dead air. Dead air is when no one is talking. Not good. I had to get to the station. I crawled through the house, gritting my teeth, inching my way out of the bedroom, down the hall, through the living room, into the foyer, out the door, under the arbor, into the gravel driveway, to my car. Somehow I managed to get the door open and pull myself inside. I sat there behind the wheel, panting and praying and reaffirming God's presence. Along the way, I had to pick up Al, my announcer, and he could see that I was in terrible pain. When we reached the station, he helped me get out of the car and into the building, and every step was like a knife through my back. I realized I'd also done something to my stomach, but the pain was so searing that I couldn't pinpoint its exact origin. Well, I'm not sure how I got through the program that day, but I do remember thinking that it was one of our best. The listening audience had no idea that every time we paused for a commercial, I broke into tears of agony. Despite being urged to go to the hospital, I returned home where I went straight to bed. There would be no more Sunday afternoon radio shows. I was unable to walk. The pain in my stomach grew more intense with each passing day. I had no insurance, no money. I knew there were clinics, but I had 5 dogs and 2 cats and a huge house to run. If I went for any kind of medical help, I knew they'd put me in a hospital. I had no family to turn to. Not only had Mama recently died, but 18 days before that, my beloved stepdad, Wally, had also died. Both deaths happened quickly and unexpectedly. Well, I did have friends, thank God, but none I could ask to take in a small zoo, though they were definitely friends. And I did have God. I continue to acknowledge him as my physician, my healer, my father. I talk to him constantly. I kept him in the front of my mind, day and night. And I talked to Dean. Still, the pain persisted. The wound to my midsection became, well, something more alarming. It spread across from one side to the other, as if I had torn my stomach in two. Helen and other friends kept insisting I see a doctor. And after 6 weeks of absolute torment, I gave in and I made an appointment. I even managed to keep it. When the doctor examined me, she said I had a tear in my stomach so deep that little more than my skin was holding me together. She sent me to a surgeon across the hall who confirmed the severity of the tear and he scheduled an operation. Meanwhile, I was able to return home, so long as I kept myself bound tightly across my midsection. During this time, it became obvious that I wasn't going to be able to keep my house. I had no income. I had literally run out of what little money I did have, so the elder owners had to put the house on the market. "Don't worry," they said. "We put it up for sale one other time, and it sat for 3 years without a soul even coming inside." They offered comfort by reminding me that some miracle might happen that would set me right financially, and I would be able to stay after all. Such was not to be. The house sold to the first couple who looked at it. I had 30 days to pack up and go. Where? On what? Friends came to my rescue in so many ways. They brought food, they cooked, they moved in for 1 or 2 days at a time, telling jokes, making me laugh, keeping my spirits high, but mostly they packed and packed and packed. 14 rooms, 4,000 square feet, that's a lot of house, a lot of things. And all the coming and going, my darling cat, Itzy, was hit by a truck. Everybody urged me to put him out of his misery and have him put down. Well, I considered it. And then I think about my own condition. Well, heck, why don't they just put me down? If we get mangled and deeply flawed, what do? We turn to God. Well, Itzy turned to me. I was the closest Itzy knew to God. One night, when I was unable to make it from the living room to my bedroom, I pulled myself into a rocking chair in front of French doors that opened onto the porch, and I looked at the beautiful sky as I had since I was a child when things got tough. Because in the sky, I see God's lovely hand. And I was rocking and thinking when I noticed Itzy, his head swollen, his eyes glazed with pain, making his way to me from across the room. He kept eye contact with me every painful step of the way, and it was as if he were thinking, if I can just get to her, I'll be all right. And I marveled at his determination. I knew it must hurt terribly to crawl across the room as he was doing. I could see the agony on his sweet little face. When he reached me, I managed to pick him up and put him in my lap. Lying on his back, cradled in my arms like a baby, he reached one paw up to gently tap my neck, and he purred. I could feel him relax. He would open his eyes just enough to look at me. Then he'd close them again, and purring, he would doze. And my eyes filled with tears. Oh, my Lord, I thought, to have that kind of faith. Itsy didn't ask me to heal him. He didn't ask anything at all of me. He simply knew that if he could somehow manage to get to me, he would be all right. I closed my eyes and rocked Itsy, and I thought my heart would just burst with gratitude. If only I could put my faith that completely in my Father. I pressed Itsy closer to me as I whispered out loud, "In your arms, God, in your arms." A little later, still unable to make it to the bedroom, I hobbled to the sofa where I fell into a troubled sleep. I had an appointment with the doctor the next morning. I was scheduled to go into the hospital where they would operate the following day, Friday. I had no idea how I'd manage to move. Where was I going? How was I going? Recuperating from an operation such as the one coming up. I had no idea how God intended to put things right. But I knew with all my heart he would, somehow. Well, I awoke with a start, still lying on the sofa. Bright morning sun poured in through the open French doors, and the first thing I noticed, even before I was fully awake, was that my stomach felt tight, as if it'd been sewn. I tentatively touched the area around my navel. What was happening? Why did it feel drawn like that? Ever so cautiously, I swung my feet to the floor. Absolutely stunned, unable to comprehend what I was experiencing, I stood up, straight up, and for the first time in 6 weeks, I was on my feet, pain-free. I tentatively touched my tummy, tight as a drum. Then I took a deep breath and performed what to me was the ultimate test. I leaned over and touched my toes with my fingertips. I was totally, absolutely healed. I sank to the sofa in disbelief. How could it be? Did God hear me when I said, "In your arms, God, in your arms"? Did he realize what I had learned from Itsy? Was healing me his way of saying, "I hear you, child"? Well, my heart hammered in my chest as I dressed to keep my doctor's appointment. Once there, he said, "So, how are we today?" "We're healed." He raised his brow, half amused. "Oh, and how'd we manage that?" I said, "I don't know. I talked to God last night, and this morning I'm healed." He grinned. He takes some of my best customers." Then more seriously, he added, "So, why are you here?" I replied, "Well, I want you to tell me it's so. I don't want it to be wishful thinking or my imagination." That must have made sense to him, because in a few moments I was stretched out on the examination table. Poking and prodding my bare stomach, he glanced at his assistant on the other side of the table. "Well," he said at last to her, "what would you like to do tomorrow? I see we have the day off." I couldn't believe my ears. "Then it's true," I said. "I really am healed?" He nodded. "You're healed." And that was that. I left the building wondering what to do next. Hadn't I been through something before where I asked what to do after a miracle? I mean, what do you do? Stop by Starbucks for a latte? Go to a movie? Yawn and take a nap? What the heck do you do? I wanted to shout to everybody who passed by that morning, "Hey, guess what? God healed me." Yep. I had a tear all the way across my stomach and a crack in my tailbone, and he healed me. How? I don't know. Something I learned from my cat. Well, I drove to Helen's house, and she was standing at the kitchen window when she saw me literally bounding up the walk to her front door. She had it open before I could even knock. With a look of utter disbelief, she exclaimed, "What happened to you?" I shrugged and grinned. "I'm healed." It sounded as absurd then as it sounds to you right now hearing this. It was just downright impossible, but it happened. I don't know how it happened or why it happened. I have no magic. I can't do a thing like that at will. Miracles, I guess they can only be experienced and not explained. Over a cup of tea, Helen and I talked about all I had learned from Itzy. Now, Helen's a practical person. She tolerates what she refers to as my impractical way of thinking, but she's also a woman of great faith. Being Catholic, her way is a bit different from mine, but we're both talking to the same God, and that's what's important. She had no better understanding of the miracle that took place sometime in the night than I had, but we had eyes to see, and what we saw was God at work. My question was this. Had I come to know God better since Dean crossed over than I knew him before that happened? My answer is yes, absolutely. Five acres lay in moonlight outside my window. Somewhere in the distance, a coyote howled. An owl hooted. I sat up in bed, in my deeply shadowed room, terrified. If I got up and looked in my purse, I'd find maybe $5. Where was I going to go on $5? Tears poured out of me in great torrents. I had completely forgotten about the miracle. I had forgotten that God was, and is, my precious Father who would no more abandon me than I would have neglected Dean had he turned to me with a pressing need. If I love Dean that much, just think how much more our Heavenly Father must love us. But I wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking about poor me and woe is me and all sorts of nonsense that made perfect sense at that middle of the night moment. I remember sitting cross-legged, bawling my eyes out, and wailing out loud, "What do you want me to do, God? Just tell me, and I'll do it. Do you want me to go back to California? Do you want me to go be with Brooke? Do you want me to stay here and found a job in Mount Dora? What should I do? I only know how to write movies. I don't know anything else." I would stop somewhere in here to draw in a ragged breath. Then I'd plow on, raging at my silent God. "Show me, God. Show me what it is you'd have me do. Just show me where you want me to go. I'm willing. I'll do whatever you want of me." And in that moment, I swear to you, I heard a voice that was at once loud and filled with authority. I repeated it so often, and I've told it to so many people, that I can repeat it here verbatim without any fear of misquoting. I heard, loudly and clearly, "Live your life for me, and I will answer your prayers, but I will not think for you." What? The room grew absolutely, totally silent. My tears snapped to a halt. I was so stunned, I couldn't breathe for a moment. I heard him. I know it was him and not just me thinking a thought to myself, because I would never, never, never have considered that he would not think for me. I fully expected to see a sign, maybe a flash in the sky that said, "Go to California," or something. I certainly did not expect to hear a loud, forceful voice tell me that if I live for him, he will answer my prayers, but that he will not think for me. Now, that was foreign to anything I'd ever considered. Stunned, I lay back on my pillow. I was on my own for sure. I was going to have to puzzle out which way to go and what the next best step would be. He'd be there to back me up, to hold my hand, but he would not think for me. Very disturbing news. I don't know how long it took, but I finally fell asleep. I realized that at least one option was out. the option that God was going to point the way for me. Later, I would come to realize that God gave me a mind and that being created in His likeness and image, I was, like it or not, capable of thinking matters through. But it sure would have been easier if He'd just done it for me. The next day, my friends returned to continue the packing chore. I had brought much of what had been in Mama's house to mine. She and my stepdad, Wally, had accumulated what I guess most couples accumulate during a 52-year marriage, plus some. Mama loved garage sales. She had a 150-mile route that she and Wally faithfully followed at least once a month, searching for other people's discarded treasures. I once asked her why she traveled so far to go to yard sales. She replied as if I had just asked the dumbest question ever devised by man. "Because that's where the rich folks live. You think I want poor people's junk?" Ah, Mama, now she was a sensible one, wasn't she? My house was jammed with beautiful tables, antique baskets, one-of-a-kind chairs and knickknacks, and I myself am keeper of things. If I give in and throw something away, sure enough, 2 weeks later, that one item will be exactly what I need. So I kept everything. At one point in my life, I even kept wire hangers. Remember the newspaper column by Heloise, the woman who knew what to do with everything? I read once where she recommended twisting wire hangers into seascapes and hanging them on your wall. An inexpensive and innovative way to decorate sounded good to me. So I twisted wire hangers into starfish and tropical fish and all sorts of fanciful doodads that I hung artfully on my office wall. My friend Barbara, an interior decorator by profession, dropped by to see my remodeling efforts. "Oh my goodness," she exclaimed, obviously impressed. "Oh, the room's beautiful. But what are all those bent coat hangers doing on the wall?" Now, packing up the Mount Dora house, I was faced with box after box of things. Mama's things, Wally's things, Dean's things, but not wire hangers. Sorry, Heloise. In the living room, Diana Reed was carefully wrapping 82 paintings and putting them in mirror boxes. Shelley Donahue and her husband John were packing dishes. There were three kitchens, one downstairs, one in the mother-in-law suite upstairs, another in the studio on the grounds beside the house. Other friends came and went, joining the rest of us in wrapping and packing while they were there. Exhausted, I plopped down on a family room sofa to rest. Helen sat in a rocking chair facing me. I could see the concern in her eyes. "Well, what are you going to do, Esther?" she asked, not for the first time. I rubbed my hand across my forehead. "I don't know." She gestured toward the living room where Diane was, complaining that she was running out of space to stack boxes. "Where are you going to put all this stuff?" I was so tired of hearing her ask those same questions every day, a dozen times a day. I had no answers. She sat back in the chair, surveying the activity going on around us, and shook her head in despair. "You don't have a cent to leave on. You have any idea where you're going?" "No, I don't," I snapped. "But God does." As she shook her head woefully, the phone on the stand beside the rocker rang. Being closest to it, she picked up the receiver. "Esther's house," she said wearily. "Yeah, she's right here, just a minute." I took the phone from her. 4 months ago, a man had called identifying himself as a Miami film producer. He asked if I'd be interested in doing a rewrite on an existing script. I said I'd take a look at it and let him know. But when he sent it to me, I could see that it was so poorly constructed, so lacking in character development, so amateurishly written, that a rewrite was impossible. They needed to scrap it entirely and start from scratch. The premise was interesting enough. A much-beloved, flamboyant attorney in Puerto Rico, who often represented the Caribbean drug cartel, but who also gave much of his time and service pro bono to those who couldn't afford legal help, had never lost a case until he was framed for murder. He was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. 12 years into the sentence, with the help of his best friend, he solved the crime from behind bars. It was a story of intrigue and even of heart. His release was celebrated by the adoring public who gifted him and his family with a lovely home and a huge welcome back party. A book had been written about him, And it was this book the Miami producer wanted turned into a viable screenplay. I asked if they had their funding in place. They didn't. I suggested he call me back when they did. When I hung up, I never expected to hear from him again. Now he was on the other end of the line saying, "We have our funds in place. Would you still be interested in writing the screenplay?" My tongue tripped over my teeth, trying to rush the word yes out of my mouth. He told me that he would wire $10,000 to me first thing in the morning, and if I would go to Puerto Rico within the next 48 hours, they would provide an electronic ticket at the Orlando airport, plus have another $10,000 waiting in cash at the airport in Puerto Rico. I was grinning ear to ear when I hung up. Helen plopped back in that chair, shaking her head. "I couldn't live like this," she groaned. "I just couldn't." With the funds, I was able to put everything in Florida Storage. I paid 6 months in advance, thinking that I would accept an invitation from Aunt Betty to come to her mountain cabin while I worked on the screenplay. I figured it would take me 6 months to complete, then I'd decide my next move. 2 days after the phone call from the producer, I was on a plane to Puerto Rico, where I met Eric Char, not his real name, the intriguing subject of the book, and the screenplay I would be writing. But something else happened while I was on the island that I still can't explain. Eric's father was quite ill. Eric and his brother took turns spending a week at the house with their mother, helping care for their ailing parent. On our way from the airport, he asked if I minded if he stopped by to see them. Inside the modest home, Eric's gray-haired mother led us into what had been the dining room. It was now a well-equipped hospital suite. I could see why this particular room was chosen. It was light and airy with a view of lush tropical flowers at every window. Eric's brother was there, as were several other relatives and friends. They were gathered in clusters around the room, chatting, leaving the frail man in the hospital bed alone. Since everyone there was speaking Spanish, and I neither speak nor understand it, I broke away from my host to examine the many framed documents lining the walls. They looked to be old newspaper and magazine stories, featuring a tall, handsome Hispanic man in some sort of uniform. A friend of Eric's stepped over to me and explained in English that the articles were about Eric's father, a distinguished soldier at one time. Once out of the service, he became a successful businessman, acclaimed for his intelligence, commercial expertise, and his humanitarian endeavors. Even without being able to read Spanish, it was easy to determine from the volume of printed stories that the man must have been quite remarkable. I turned to study the old fellow. He was little more than a withered leaf. A tube ran from his nose to a machine beside his bed. I assumed it was oxygen. His neck arched back on the pillow as if struggling to keep his nose above water. The body was bent with age and ailment, his long, slender fingers drawn up like claws. I was intrigued by the fact the dashing man in the pictures could curl into the pathetic soul lying there in front of me. I took a step closer. His eyes registered nothing. He seemed not to be aware of anything around him. The reed-like legs were drawn up under a white sheet. His scrawny arms lay close to his fragile body. And I leaned in over the bed rail to have a closer look. No one was paying us the least bit of attention. I concentrated entirely on the man in the bed, thinking intensely about who he had been, who he was, even now. Inside that withered casing was intelligence. I could sense it. Finally, I leaned even closer to him, and I whispered, "Hello, sir. I realize you don't speak English, but I hope you can tell from the tone of my voice how very honored I am to meet you." Now, if I word this 10,000 different ways, I don't think I'll be able to convey what happened next, but I'll try. Eric's father shifted his eyes to mine. He didn't just look at me, he looked at me. He looked into me. He saw me, and he knew what I was saying. But that still isn't the entire story. I was leaning over him, maybe 7 or 8 inches from his face, looking intently into his eyes, when he met my gaze. In that moment, I saw his eyes as he must have looked when he was a young man. They were bright and alive. They were intelligent and kind, and they were separate from the rest of him. They were suspended, perhaps 4 inches out from his face, superimposed over his elderly eyes, so that I could see through the young eyes to the face on the pillow. Those young eyes smiled at me. There was a twinkle in them that was bright with life. I was speechless. My mind was whirling, trying to take it all in, to etch it in my memory so that I would never forget this remarkable moment. It lasted perhaps 5-10 seconds, and then the young eyes disappeared. But the elderly face seemed to take on a glow, and the old eyes, apparently sightless a few moments ago, held on mine. I had reached him. We'd connected at the deepest level, at the soul level. I smiled at the wonderful old man, and I turned to Eric, and I attempted to tell him what had happened, but of course he didn't understand. He said something like, sometimes we think he might recognize one of us. But he really didn't get what I was trying to say. I've never told anybody else before now because I don't fully understand it myself. And I don't know how to describe it other than the way I just did. I can't even comprehend the significance of what transpired that day in the dining hospital room. But I know something powerful took place. Maybe someday Dean will tell me all about it in terms I can understand. The trip to Puerto Rico was rich with experience. I was eager to get started on the screenplay. I returned to the mainland. Puerto Rico is one of our territories, therefore it is part of the United States. I returned 5 days later, picked up my furry kids in Mount Dora, took enough clothes with me to wear for 6 months in the desert, and pointed the Chrysler LeBaron convertible I had inherited from my parents toward California.
You've been listening to Dear Dean, Love, Mom, told by its author Esther Luttrell, and brought to you by The Voice of Helona in association with Mojave Beach Productions. The Voice of Helona theme was composed and performed by David Randa of Fesleyan Studios. Patrick McGranahan produced. This production was recorded by Dean Fairweather. Funding for Dear Dean, Love, Mom was made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the support of all aspects of forgiveness in families, communities, businesses, and personal relationships. Visit their website at forgivenessfoundationinternational.com. This is Jeff Evans, inviting you to soar on the wings of imagination to Mojave Beach Productions' World of Audio Entertainment.
Mojave Beach Productions.
I just want to take a moment to thank you for soaring with us on the wings of imagination as you listen to stories we're having so much fun creating for you. If you enjoy what you hear, take a moment to subscribe to Mojave Beach Productions on your favorite podcast app. And thanks a million.